Now that it is the 3 weeks leading up to Tisha B'Av, and that's a time to look at the question of, it's a heavy time of year, it's a time of destruction, most difficult time of year for us historically. In the spiritual cycle, this is where the problems are located. Each time is associated with its own spiritual energy, and of course the focus is always not simply on what's happening, but obviously what the correct response is to that time energy. So let's look at a subject that is relevant to the issue of the difficulties that this time of year brings, and the subject of destruction of the temple and of true Jewish life and of the spiritual life, spiritual path, I suppose, in general, and see if we can use that understanding to build something just a little bit new, maybe. I mean, we don't, in terms of correcting ourselves, which is the first step in the rebuilding, obviously, is to acknowledge the destruction, to know that there's an inner disconnection, and to use that to seek a reconnection. So we're in a situation now where there's no one really to tell us what's wrong with us, and to there's no one capable of doing that. There's no one who can stand up in front of this audience or any other who's capable of being critical. There's no one who knows how to take it anymore. As the Gemara says, no one who knows how to give it. But let's try together to study the subject of what's wrong with us, basically. Or at least one avenue of understanding how we approach the fact that there may be something wrong with us. See if we can open a chink in the armor that that defends us or protects us against the armor of our insensitivity. Let's try and do that. So here you have, the Gemara says this. Gemara in Sota says like this. The Gemara is talking about an incident that occurred in the life of Agrippus. Agrippus was a king who had a difficult historical juncture in Jewish history, who should not really have been king. He really was invalid. But he was, de facto, he was the king at the time. When Agrippus got up in Jerusalem in front of the people to read, to fulfill the mitzvah of reading from the Torah the way the king is supposed to, when he got to the verse that says, Gemara says like this, Tana Mishmeri Rabbi Nosson, he said like this, when he got to the part that says, you shall not put a king over you who is not from your people, you may not appoint a king over you, a foreigner, somebody's not from you. I'm not going to go into the halachic details now. Zalgu Einav Demas, his eyes flowed with tears. This is the incident that occurred. Because he was from improper stock. He was from a background that really invalidated him from being the king. Although he held the position. So when he read the verse that invalidated himself, the tears began flowing. So the Jews who were there at the time said to him the following thing. Amruloi, they said, Altis yare Agrippus, do not fear Agrippus. Achinu ata achinu, you are our brother, you are our brother. That's what they said. They said to him, appeased him and they said, you are our brother. So the Gemara says on that event like this. At that moment, the enemies of the Jewish people entered a situation where they deserved to be destroyed. Klaya means total annihilation. Now, you know, when the Gemara says that the enemies of the Jewish people deserve annihilation, it doesn't mean the enemies, it means us. But we can't say words like that. We don't say that. Words have power. And we're very cautious about saying things that are negative. So we switch the words, but you have to reverse this, right? This is a extreme form of euphemism. When it says that our enemies deserve destruction, it's really referring to us. In other words, the Jewish people entered a situation where they forfeited their right to exist when they said to him, "Don't worry, you're okay." Why? Shechnifuloil Agrippas, at the moment when they flattered Agrippas. That's what it says. What was the crime? Flattery. Amar Rabbi Shimon ben Chalafta, Miyom shegava egroifa shel chanufa, from the day that the fist of flattery entered the ascendancy, nisavsu adinim, justice and law became perverted, niskalkul amaisim, there was a situation a distorted situation arose in which things began to go wrong. No person can any longer say to anyone else, "My deeds are greater than yours." This is what happened. This is a very strange language, this. You notice it says, from the day that the fist of flattery became ascendant. That's a very strange language. Flattery is not something you would describe as a fist normally, not in the English idiom. In the English idiom, you might speak of the velvet glove of flattery. Flattery is a thing when you say to a person gently, "You're okay, you're beseder, don't worry." If anything, that's a velvet glove, it's not a fist. It's not a mailed fist. There's something strange about the metaphor here, the idiom. Are we together? Anyone out there? If you have a sensitive ear, you'll stop on those words. When you describe flattery and you want to use the correct turn of phrase, the correct turn of phrase for flattery would be something like a silk, you know, touch or a velvet glove. You wouldn't call it the mailed fist of flattery. That seems to be a jarring metaphor. That's what it says. That's when things began to go wrong. Doesn't only mean, obviously, the event, that particular event. Flattery in the world. And people flatter each other. Flattery meaning to say things that are complimentary in the exact point where there should be criticism. That's what flattery is. Then the Gemara continues talking about the question of flattery, discusses the subject. Gives examples. And then the Gemara says this fascinating thing. It says like this. V'amar Rebbe Elazar. And Rebbe Elazar said, "Kol adam sheyesh bo chanufa," any person who has the quality of flattery, a flatterer, "afilu ubrim shebimei imon mekalalinoisit," even unborn children in their mother's wombs, curse such an individual. Shenemar, he brings a verse to support it. The verse says, "Eimel larosha tzadikato," a person who says to an evil person, "You are righteous," "yikavu amim," "yizamu leumim," he shall be cursed by nations, and he shall be castigated maybe by peoples. And then the Gemara brings a proof that language refers to unborn children. The word kov in Hebrew means to curse, and it brings a proof for it. And Ein la'om ela ubrin, and the word la'om, which means a nation or a nationality, really has the connotation of unborn children, and the Gemara proves it. In other words, the Gemara is saying here that the very strange thing, that somebody who flatters is cursed by unborn children. That requires explanation. What is the curse of an unborn child? What is being said here? Deep ideas needs something very deep being said here. We need to try to fathom this. To the best of my knowledge, there's only one other place in the Talmud that describes the curse of an unborn child. Gemara says this. The Gemara says, the Sanhedrin, the following language. Amar Rabbi Shimon Chasida. Said Rabbi Shimon Chasida, Kol hamoneh halacha mipi talmid, anybody who prevents who withholds a halacha, that means who fails to teach, withholds Torah teaching, even one halacha, that means one element, let's say, of practical Torah teaching from a student, afilu ubrim shebemei imoy mekala neoisei, even children unborn in the mother's womb curse such an individual. Shenemar, because it says, Moneya bar yikavu loin, one who withholds food is cursed by a nation. And then the Gemara says, "Ve'en lo'im ala ubrin," and the word lo'om means unborn children, the fetus, like it says before, and bar means food, but in a deeper level it means Torah. Now the derivation is not important now, but that's the comment. So you have here an amazing thing. You have here a statement. You have here two statements, yeah? Two parallel statements in the Talmud. One is that, and I don't think, as far as I know, there aren't other ways of incurring this particular form of curse. So let's try and put it together. What's being said here? What is being said? A person who flatters. You say, it's okay. Person has a deficiency, and instead of pointing out the deficiency, you say, it's okay. Achino, you're our brother. You gloss over and you caress at a place where it would be more fitting to criticize. Such a person incurs the curse of an unborn child. And in parallel, a person who is teaching and fails to teach, a person who teaches Torah and fails to teach Torah, Moneya halacha mipi talmid, that means he does not teach his student. He could teach and he doesn't. Of course, we're not referring to people here who shouldn't be teaching. Obviously, that's probably a more serious crime. People who should not be teaching and are teaching, who distort and are incapable, right? Just like a surgeon who fails to operate is highly culpable, you can well imagine that a surgeon who should not be operating and does is at least equally culpable, maybe more. We're not talking about such. We're talking about an individual who has something to share. Someone with Torah knowledge who has something to share. And a person fails to do it, fails to teach, has a spiritual knowledge, and withholds it from the one who could benefit. That's all. Nothing active. It doesn't harm him directly. Just withholds. And it could be well-intentioned, too. It could be out of modesty. A person could say, who am I to teach? Who's going to listen to me? But he withholds his teaching, so he's cursed by the same unborn child who curses the individual who flatters. That's what's being said. The idea of teaching Torah, of elevating other people spiritually, along with one's own development, that is clearly an obligation. In this generation, it's more true than it ever was, because we are a generation of Jews who basically know almost nothing. Even the knowledgeable among us, compared to previous generations, are almost without knowledge. And the majority of Jews in this generation, not only without knowledge, but don't even know that there is a knowledge to be had. I'm not sure which is the dominant factor in Jewish life today. Those who don't even know, or those who are absolutely confident that they know what it is and it's not worth having. I'm not sure. I don't know which is... It's probably a close... The majority of world Jewry today, in surveys done over the last few years, indicate that they profess no attachment to anything Jewish. The majority of Jews, certainly American Jews, profess no connection to anything Jewish at all. I mean, the survey I'm thinking of, which is a national survey done in America a few years ago, an association with a Jewish weightlifting club was considered valid. That means if you belong to a Jewish book club or a Jewish social center, anything that had any Jewish identity at all, let alone religious, let alone, that was accepted as Jewish identification. And 52% of American Jews register zero contact or identification with any point of Jewish identity at all, cultural, sporting, academic, anything. That means you have 52% of Jews who would intermarry, not because they reject the Jewish issue, but they don't even know that it's an issue. And of those who do have some, or claim to have some attachment or knowledge, many of them have a decidedly negative preconception, no question about that. So we are in a situation today of lack of attachment to Jewish identity or to... and though many Jews who have profess a spiritual interest are place that interest elsewhere, there's no question about that. So we're living through a destruction of unprecedented proportions. Not a destruction of the Jewish people. Let's not make a mistake about that. We've never been anxious about numbers. That's not the issue. There's a very important misunderstanding in Jewish community work, a widespread misunderstanding, and that is that we need numbers. We've always been the smallest. We've always been the smallest. The verse praises us. The Torah praises us as being the smallest. On the contrary, the concept is quality. It's not quantity. We're not looking for numbers. And furthermore, we're not concerned about numbers for Jewish survival, because numbers are irrelevant to Jewish survival. The reason numbers are irrelevant to Jewish survival is because Jewish survival is guaranteed and promised. There's no problem with Jewish survival. The reason that we're concerned about Jews who detached is for those Jews who detached. We're not concerned Jewish efforts to swell numbers, right, and to use various methods, including anti-halachic methods, to swell the ranks of Jews or so-called Jews. On the contrary, that itself is a destruction. The Jewish people is a tree that is guaranteed to survive. That has been guaranteed, the Torah guarantees it, the future of the Jewish people and the Messianic redemption and the whole world's survival in its spiritual is all completely guaranteed. That's not our problem. The problem with the trees is that the leaves fall off. We're concerned, Jewish outreach, you want to, Kiruv, outreach, that many people become very dedicated to that effort to reach out to Jews who don't share background. The reason is not because we need them for our survival, we need them for their survival. That's the situation today. And therefore, it's for that reason that anybody who can teach in this generation has a particular, not just talking about a learned individual who knows how to teach Torah and should not selfishly keep it to himself or herself, but should share, teach. Here we have a life-saving obligation. Not simply that this student could learn more. Perhaps the best illustration I can think of is an incident that occurred in the life of Yisrael Salanter. Yisrael Salanter, talking about 2 centuries ago, or thereabouts, 1.5 centuries, there was an incident in his lifetime when the Jews in Kovno, some Jews came to him and they said, there's a tzaddik nista in Kovno. And some Jews were working in some factory or some, and they heard a Jew, one of the men working there, when they got close to him, they heard that while he was working, he was chazering Yerushalmi Baal Peh. He was going over the Talmud, the Jerusalem Talmud, orally by heart. Now, no one studies the Jerusalem Talmud until they've mastered the Babylonian Talmud. So somebody who is already revising by heart during his menial labor the whole of the Jerusalem Talmud must be a unique sage. When they approached this man and accosted him, he, being unaware that anyone had heard, he denied any knowledge of anything Jewish at all. He said, no, it was just a menial laborer. He would not admit. So the people were distressed by it, and they went to the great Torah sage of the time, Rabbi Shaul Salant, and they said to him, there's a tzaddik nista in Kovna. There's a hidden, righteous, great learned man in Kovna. And they told him the story. What shall we do? And his answer is really very illuminating. His answer was as follows. You understand how he put his answer. He said like this. He said, you're probably making a mistake. You're probably wrong. It's probably somebody imagined it and they got it wrong. And he's probably just a simple individual who knows nothing as he claims. Why do I say that? Because we can't afford hidden tzaddikim in this generation. There were times when the Jewish people could afford great righteous individuals who remained secret and hidden. On the contrary, that was part of their greatness. There's a Kabbalistic tradition that every generation has 36 righteous individuals who have certain spiritual characteristics who are hidden. 36. Inside Israel, 36. Outside Israel, it's a big subject. And they keep the world. The world depends, the world's survival is in the merit of these pure and righteous individuals, and they are hidden. But there were many who retained their hidden nature, the humility and the spiritual work required it. He said, we no longer can afford hidden people like that. Why? The way he put it was like this. He said, when the battle's being lost and there's a destruction on the battlefield, that's the time when even the injured and crippled soldiers have to get out on the battlefield. Normally, the people who are not fit, they're exempt from war, and it's only those who are able-bodied who fight the war. But when the war's being lost and the enemy incursion is becoming desperate, then you have to take the wounded and those in the hospitals and you have to get them out. Anybody who can hold a weapon has to be out there. The Jewish people is in that situation at present, and therefore anybody who's capable of teaching at all, we can't afford the luxury of such a person remaining hidden. And therefore, if he's as great as you think he is, he would know this, and he would know that he cannot remain hidden, and he would not do that. However, if you're right, and he is what you claim he is, then he's great enough to know what he's doing, leave him alone. Which means that his answer was, at one and the same time, the correct education on the subject and a cover for the man's identity. That's a wise answer. But we learn from this answer, among many other things, that we can't afford the luxury of people who have the ability to teach, who do not teach. And it's for that reason that many people in this generation would in previous generations have been considered completely immature in their own learning. In this generation, have to get out and share with those who have even less. Rav Moshe Feinstein, it's well known, ruled halachically, that any Jew who has any Torah learning is obliged to spend 10% of his time in learning with someone who knows less. Just like you have an obligation to pay 10% of your after-tax income to a charitable cause, it's a halachic obligation, he said that extends to your time. Any Torah learning ability that you have, any Torah teaching ability that you have no right to spend 100% of that time on your own learning. You have to give, of course you realize immediately that 10% of your time teaching someone else is your best learning time. Because in sharing your learning and working it out and taking responsibility and learning with someone else, you learn far more. Anyway. But be that as it may. He said this in connection with Russian Jews who came out of Russia. There's purportedly a million Jews in Russia today. There are a million Russian Jews in America today. There are a million Russian Jews in Israel today. The vast majority of whom have no connection at all. And are willing to learn. And are interested. So he said, anyone who has any ability, you cannot sit and learn while there's a greater starvation in this field of spiritual wisdom. And that's why this Gemara says that it's wheat or food, which is the metaphor for Torah, because it's a sustenance of the neshama, just like that food is the sustenance of the body. And therefore you have to share. So somebody who withholds Torah teaching is guilty of this, is cursed by the unborn child. So again, that's with particular reference to our generation. But the fact remains, in any generation, Hamoneh halacha mipi talmid, somebody who withholds Torah teaching from a student is guilty of this particular sin and incurs the curse of the unborn child. Somebody who is flattering is doing the same thing. What's the explanation? There's a third Gemara which we can use to open the subject. The Gemara says like this. It's Gemara Nida and Daf Lamed. The Gemara says this. I didn't bring it here, but I'll quote for you what the Gemara says. The Gemara says, Darash Rebbe Simlai. What is the semblance of an unborn child. Lema ubadem, what does the fetus look like within the mother? And he starts to give a drosha about what the child looks like. He describes the fetal position and which parts of the baby are the way the child is disposed in the mother. And in this description he says the following thing. V'ne'er daluk al roshei, he has a light lit above his head, literally on his head. He has a light lit on his head. U'boid seifim es seif oilem vat seif, and he looks with this light from one end of the world to the other. And while the child unborn has this light that's lit above his head and sees all of reality, he's taught the whole Torah. He's taught an angel, a malach, an angel is teaching the child the whole Torah during the months of his pregnancy, month of his incubation. He's taught the whole Torah. Actually, the depth of it is that he's taught his own chelik in Torah. In other words, the child learns. Not only he learns, the meaning here is the child learns the entire expanse of the spiritual world. He knows, he learns, he studies the entire spiritual, he knows everything he needs to know about the world with particular reference to his own role. Each Jew, actually this is not necessarily with reference to Jews, each human being has a particular place in time and space and history, and the child is shown it all. He's shown his own tachlis, his own perfection. He's shown what he could become if he invests his life correctly. He lacks nothing, he's shown everything. And kevan sheyotzel aviroi, when he comes out to the air of the world, as the child is born, ba malach, an angel appears, the satra al piv, strikes him on the mouth, umashakhes kolad, and causes him to forget the whole Torah. And the child is born as a simple unlearned baby, like any child, any baby, is born without knowing anything at all. That's the process. He's inwardly a spiritual being. The verse the Gemara quotes is "Mi yitneni kiyarchei kerem," a most beautifully evocative pasuk. "Mi yitneni kiyarchei kerem ki mei alakai yishmereini." Not that any pasuk in Torah needs skoma, obviously, but who could give me like those yarchei kerem, those months of yore? Ki mei alakai yishmereini, when the days of Hashem, my God, protected me. Says the Gemara, what do you learn from this verse? Mi yitneni ke yarchei kerem. Who could give me like those months of former times? Says the Gemara, what are months that are not years? Why does the verse call it months? What are months that are not years? Says the Gemara, pregnancy. Because pregnancy is months that are less than a year. And therefore we can derive that this verse is referring to the months of the unborn child, which are the most ecstatic period, most ecstatic period of a person's life. And the spiritual expression here is the longing for those months of spiritual ecstasy. And then as the child's born, he loses that knowledge, and he has no more, has it no more. But there are many things to question here, of course. One of them is, what does it mean, a light lit on his head? You know, it says a light is lit on his head, and he sees from it. That light he sees from one end of the world to the other. You know, when you want to see something, you shine a light on the thing, not on you. What is the sense of a light lit above on his head? Ner daluk al roisha. There's a light lit on his head. What does that mean? But you see, the meaning here is to analyze the words carefully. It doesn't mean that a light is cast on the world. A light is lit on him. It means he sees himself. He sees the world in himself. That's what it means. The light is the light that's lit in the head. He doesn't need to see the outside world. He sees it refracted through his own, the lens of his own neshama. That's what he sees. He's the ultimate spiritual being, this child. And then he's born and he loses it all. There are many beautiful things there. The Gemara says he's kapinkas. The child is folded. The fetal position is a folded position. The Gemara there describes it as a pinkas. A pinkas in English, hard to translate. It's like a ledger or a... a storekeeper's notebook in which he keeps his accounts. It's like a notebook that is I think the Maharal says that one of the meanings in this is that a person is unborn. There's a Kabbalistic meaning as well, what this folded position means. But one of the layers of meaning is that a person unborn is like a folded account book, which has not yet been opened for the accounts to be written. That's what it means. as the person is born, he unfolds. The book is opened, the accounts start to be written. So the question is that, many questions here. One question is, why is he struck? The angel strikes him a blow that caused him to forget the whole Torah. One of the questions is, why a blow on the mouth? To cause someone to forget something, the more appropriate thing is a blow on the head. Why is it a blow on the mouth? It also needs explanation. But we can't deal with everything in one session. Let's pick our way through the elements that we need. What is the purpose of this process? What's the meaning of this process? What is the process of a child learning the whole Torah and then having it a blow? This is the if you want to know where the fist applies, the power of a mailed fist that punches down, this is where it takes place. This is the original blow. And that blow causes the child to forget. And the question, the obvious question is, what is the purpose of teaching a child the whole Torah if you make him forget? The purpose of life is not to be an unborn child. The purpose of life is to be born in the world and live a life here. Why is the child taught the whole Torah before he's born and then forget it? What kind of process is that? What is the meaning of this? And the answer is something like this. This is a key idea in understanding many things, and I think we've had opportunity in our discussions before to approach this from various other perspectives, but let's try to unlock, use this key, understand it. Let's try to use this key to understand our subject. The process of life is as follows. Again, stay with me carefully, because this is the core. All of life consists of this process. All of life consists, and there's no more important message than this. Understanding this message correctly is literally life-saving. Missing this message can make the difference between a life of purpose and achievement and a life of complete existential disaster. The process or the pattern of life is always a process in which there is a gift of inspiration. There's a light lit. The Kabbalistic sources talk about a light that is lit above the head is a, without going into the jargon and the technicalities, but it's a light that could not be visible in this world. It's a light that is so intense that by that light is revealed all of reality. When it was revealed in this world, the Gemara says, by that light you see into things. You don't see the surface of things, you see through them. It's identified with the notion of the Oragonus, the hidden light, the light of creation. Which of course was the fetal situation of the world, which then was extinguished, the same pattern. This is the light that is the light of reality that exposes things inside. That light is shone and then it's taken away. And when the light is taken away, there's a situation of darkness. But not just a darkness. There's a big difference between a darkness that never had a light and a darkness that was once illuminated. A person who's always lived in a darkness and does not know what light is one type of human situation. But a person who has lived in the ecstasy of whatever it may be, a relationship, spiritual knowledge, and then as it's taken away, that's where the real pain, the pain of an indescribable longing. Now that's a darkness. And then there's a rekindling of that light, but not like the first time. The first time is a free gift. The second time is blood, sweat, effort. It is the effort that's needed to generate that light only through pain and effort. And that's the process of life. Let's try to understand this well. All of life, the spiritual pattern of all of life, is that there's first a free gift, it's taken away, and the challenge is to get back to that situation, but not as a free gift, but rather through work. The reason for this is that the purpose of being here is not to have a free gift. The purpose of being here is to achieve your own fulfillment, right? Your own assertion of essence, your own expression of essence. But your own assertion, not as a free gift. But the problem is, if you've never been shown it once before, then if you've never been given that experience, if you've never been uplifted, if you've never been given the thrill of being there once before, you could not know what was meant. And therefore, first there's a demonstration. First there's an unreal elevation. And at the moment of greatest thrill, in fact, if you want to know the moment with perfect accuracy, the moment that it's taken away is the moment at which you become completely convinced that it will last forever. As soon as you've reached that situation in life, when you know that this is perfect, the experience is perfect and never die, at that moment it's taken away. And then there's the disappointment and the agony of having it withdrawn. There's the feeling of abandonment and of... And the challenge is to climb back to where you were before, but this time you climb. Perhaps the best way to illustrate this is a few examples. Let's try to understand. You see it everywhere. On a national level, the Jewish people were taken out of Egypt in a blaze of miracles. Right? You want to talk about the birth process of that fetus, which is the Jewish people? So that's what happens. In Egypt, the Jewish people are exposed to miraculous demonstrations without any effort. They were on the 49th level of impurity, of all on the verge of spiritual destruction. They're uplifted for free. 10 plagues reaching a crescendo of spiritual illumination. 7 days later at the sea split. They saw many times more than they saw in Egypt. The Gemara there says, the sources say there, that the lowliest Jew present saw then more than the highest prophet ever saw subsequently. So an experience of indescribable elevation, reaching an indescribable peak, and the next step is they were dropped in a desert and told to walk towards Sinai through the blazing desert sand. The desert always means, in Torah thinking, a place of death. Desert always means a place of death. Midbar in Hebrew means a place that's mufka from dibur. You know, midbar is based on the root dabar. Dabar means meaningful conduct, right? Meaningful translation of ideas into expression. Midbar is a place where there's none of that. It's completely severed from spiritual connection. No water means no life. Yeah, the concept is that in the Exodus, we were lifted to the 50th level of spiritual greatness, and then we were dropped in the desert, and the instruction was to get back to the 50th level, the 50th day after the Exodus, to reach the receiving of the Torah, bonding in oneness, the Jewish people with Hashem, step by step, in a desert, yeah, in a day after day, step by, an agonizing walk through a desert. And that's the symbol, the symbolism. Again, there's a demonstration for free. You know what the desert means? The desert, what happened in the desert? Subsequently, when they ended up in the desert for the rest of the many years that they spent there, they faced 10 ordeals in the desert and failed all of them. The concept spiritually is that all 10 dimensions of the world's evil were thrown at them. The world is built in 10 layers, 10 spiritual layers. Each one, a different emanation of spirituality. The world of evil is a contamination of all of those layers. In fact, it's well known, and we mentioned it before, that the reason there were 10 plagues in Egypt was because each of them was a divine demonstration of how to destroy evil in that dimension. But that's why, and I mentioned it before again, that's why the world is built with 10 sayings. For example, the first one is Bereshis, in the beginning. The second, Yehi'or, let there be light. You have here, in the beginning is always the nucleus that has no dimension. The inner point that is dimensionless. Then there's a layer around that, and a layer around that, until you have 10 layers of reality that are constructed. In Egypt, what happened was an unfolding, a peeling away of the layers from outside in. That's why some of our sources indicate that the plagues in Egypt proceeded in reverse order from the sayings of creation. The world is built with 10 sayings, starting with a dimensionless point in the center, and 10 layers are built around it. But when you detoxify a structure, then you start on the outside and you peel away layers until you reach the pure center. And that's why it goes that way. The first of the sayings of creation is in the beginning. The last of the plagues, which is a correction of that point, is destruction of the firstborn. The purification of the moment of firstness. The second of the sayings of creation is let there be light. The second last of the plagues was the plague of darkness. You hear what's going on here? In other words, there's a process of reversal where That was a demonstration of how you deal with all 10 layers of evil and you purify those layers. In the desert, the Jewish people's challenge was, you see how it's done? You were spectators, you watched the show, now you do it. You do it. And of course, we failed, right? 10 layers of facing evil, the opportunity to reach. What was the journey? That's what we're reading now in this week's parasha, right? Matos, Masa is the question of, Masa is the question of journey, the journey. What is that journey, the journey of life? That's the journey from Egypt to Israel. That's what the journey, Israel, you understand? Say a word about this. The journey is the journey from Mitzrayim to Israel. Mitzrayim means the land of spiritual impurity. Mitzrayim in Hebrew spells Meitzar Yam. The land that constricts the 50th. The 50th is always transcendent. 49 are the layers of the natural. The 50th is the transcendent world. Egypt is Meitzar Yam. It's the one that... what are we in now these 3 weeks? Called Benham Mitzarim. Mitzrayim. We are now back in an Egypt dimension. A squeezing of spirituality. A closing of the head. That's what Benham Mitzarim means. Mitzrayim means it constricts the 50th. Does not allow the spiritual transcendence to reveal itself. You go from that situation, which is the animal level of Ervas Haaretz, that means only physicality, no spiritual world open at all, to the 50th level, which is the world of transcendence, of giving Torah. That's what the journey is. Yes? That journey, the entire journey was from Egypt, which is that, to Israel, which is the opposite. That's the journey. And on that journey, there are 10 layers of evil to be destroyed. And we failed. So what's the experience? The experience again. Blaze of illumination, elevated for free, lifted up into that ecstasy, and then dropped cruelly into a desert situation, and you walk towards Sinai yourself. Do you want an analogy? It's like when a father teaches his child to walk. He takes the child by the hands for the first time, and he lifts him to his feet. This child is now in an ecstatic situation. He's standing for the first time in his life, and he takes his first incredible step. But not only does he experience the ecstasy of taking a step, but he's secure. He can't fall. Abba's holding his hands. And just at the moment when the child feels the ecstasy, the thrill of that first step in his life, is when his Abba lets go. And then the child finds himself in a terrifying situation. He's standing. He doesn't know how to move from here. And the one who put him into the situation of ecstasy is the one who put him into the situation of abandonment. So there's the sense of abandonment and of a cruel letdown, and ecstasy turns to terror. But it's then that he learns to walk. It's then that he learns to walk. The first step was not walking. The first step was a very, very superficial illusion of walking, but it was necessary. And then when the hands are let go and he takes the next step unaided is when he learns to walk. And then he can rush into his father's arms and understand that in the moment of abandonment was a greater love manifest than when his father held his hands. If the Abba had not lifted him up and shown him how to do it, he never... But then you have to be abandoned. That's the message of life. The message of life is that the phase of free elevation, the fly now is always, there's a fly now, but there's a pay later. That's the way it works. There's a fly now, there's an elevation, there's an ecstasy that's given, there's an educational experience where the hands are held. But it's taken away. And all of life is like that. There's nothing in life that isn't like that. The beginning of a relationship, a marriage, for example. Now's not the time to go into discussion of marriage. But a marriage is like that. There's a natural thrill in the beginning of a relationship. The world is built that way. A new friendship, a new love. Marriage begins. The world is built in such a way that there is a natural thrill. There's an ecstasy in the flash of the explosion of newness. But the world built in such a way that it cannot last. The reason it's given in the beginning is a completely unreal experience. We don't want to insult the discussion by bringing it down to making it too practical. But I just say one word is that, this experience in the West is called romance. And in Hebrew there's no word for that. In Hebrew, in the language of Torah, there's no word for that. We have a word for love. Love means giving. Ahava means have, to give. Ava adds up to 13, which is the same numerical equivalent as Echad, which means one. Love being one doesn't mean... What love really means as one means a giving of self so intensely. You have to understand, love meaning oneness between two does not mean the romantic notion of two people becoming one in a bond. It doesn't mean that at all. Love being one means each party giving himself or herself so intensely into this relationship that he doesn't live anymore outside of the other. Love is generated where you give yourself entirely, and the reason is because you can only love yourself. You can only love yourself. The real intensity of love is not where you love another, but when the other becomes you. Genuine love is not where one loves another. Genuine love is where one expands to become a larger one than he or she was before. And then the other isn't love, the other is identified with self. That's why love means one. But that happens for free. There's a natural ecstasy, the natural inspiration in those things in the beginning. And then always disappears. When does romance disappear? You want to be put it bluntly. Romance disappears exactly at the moment that one becomes convinced that it will last forever. That's exactly the moment. And of course, in Western thinking, the mistake of Western thinking is what's portrayed is romance, but it's called love. And that's why it doesn't last, obviously. That's not the message. The message is that it's given as a free thrill in order to be a demonstration. But then it's taken away. And it's taken away for a purpose. It's taken away so that it can be built genuinely by the genuine work of creating the self. And the whole world is that way. There's no experience in the world that's not like that. We could spend all night discussing the subject, but we're talking about the destruction of the temple. That's what the 3 weeks are about. Were there not two? The first temple and the second? The first was the one of perfection. The Shekhinah was there, the divine presence. The second was so desolate compared to the first. The Gemara says that people who saw the second temple, who had seen the first, wept when they saw the second. Because the first light is a light of intensity. It's perfect. The second is the one... How many times were the tablets given? The Luchos HaBris. The Luchot. The tablets. Twice. The first were carved by Hashem. They were divine. Completely miraculous. Completely. But those were broken. The first light is always withdrawn. The first experience always breaks. There's a blow that breaks them. And the second were carved by human. Those are the ones that last. The ones that lasted were the ones carved by human hand. And there's no place in Torah and there's no place in life that this idea is not at play. And of course, misunderstanding this is the ultimate tragedy, because instead of knowing, the whole point is to know that life is a free experience, an experience of thrill, that sooner or later, and it's usually sooner, is taken away. And you can cut life any way you want. You don't have to take childhood and adulthood. Childhood is a time of inspiration. Children have an inspiration about the world. Children have a free gift of a thrill of expectation. The world is larger than life to a child. A normal, psychologically normal child is totally convinced that the whole world is his, that he can do anything, everything. Every 18-year-old male is completely and utterly convinced that he is going to be the world's greatest everything. But the normal, that 18-year-old male, when he's 28 and 38 and 48 and 58 and he's not the world's greatest anything. That's where the light is taken away. The reason is that when you're young, when you're a child and a teenager, you're given an experience of thrill that is free. The purpose is to show you what you could be. But that's taken away and you have to make that you. And the ultimate expression of that in the Gemara, in the Torah, is the fetus. The child, the unborn child, is taught the whole Torah. He knows it all. He is there. Then there's a blow and it's taken away. And the challenge is, you see what you could be? There's an impression. The Kabbalistic jargon is a... Words are not important, but there's an impression. There's an impression, there's an intimation left in his consciousness of where he once was. You're born knowing that you can do it. Why do you know that you're capable of greatness? Because you once were there. You know, when you hear spiritually meaningful, if you hear something spiritually true, you do not, if you've ever lived, you will know that when you hear something that is spiritually accurate, you do not have the sensation of learning something, you have the sensation of recognizing something. It's very hard to put into words, but that's the experience. Because you're not learning, you're recognizing it. You were there once before, you knew that. And when you hear it, you know. How do you know a thing is true? How, when something resonates and you know it's true, how do you know it's true? The reason is because you identify. It rings, it resonates, it vibrates. A chord is struck with a chord that's there. If you never were there before, you wouldn't know that. If you'd never been there before, you wouldn't know that it was true. You'd hear a fact and another fact, a right fact, a wrong fact. It's not like that. When you hear a correct fact, and particularly one that is yours, particularly one that touches you, that is your spirituality, when you hear that, you know, you ring like a bell. The reason is because there's an intimation, there's a chord waiting to be struck. It once was ringing. This is how people who learn Torah can say a chidushin Torah. Person learns Torah, and they come up with an original idea. Original idea? How can you say an original idea in Torah? Who are you to make up Torah? The Torah is Hashem's. The answer is you had it once before. This is your Torah. Your life is simply an expression of bringing out the original primordial Torah that was in. You've been there before. You know it all. It's all within. It's a question of if you've never been shown that before, you'll never be able to get there again. Birth is the process of having it taken away. You know what a blow means? The angel comes and gives the child a blow. We're not going to discuss now why it's a blow in the mouth. That needs its own discussion. You know what a blow means? A blow is always, it's the Torah's way of saying a demonstration of deficiency. A blow is always the cruel demonstration of where listen to this statement. You don't have a single blade of grass. She'ein lo malach barakia. There doesn't have an angel in the higher dimension. She'make oiso. That strikes it. Ve'emel lo gedal. And says grow. How does a blade of grass grow? How does a blade of grass grow in the world? So, a biological explanation. You know what the spiritual explanation is? There's a blade of grass that is trying to grow. And at every moment in its life, it's struck a blow by a spiritual force. And that blow is a statement, grow. The blow means that this entity in the world is shown its dimension of deficiency. It's shown the lack that it needs to swell to. When you shine your deficiency, when you shine where you lack, you can grow to fill that lack. If you never shown the lack, you can't grow to fill it. The way, again, I have to understand this, the way a blade of grass grows in the world, it doesn't grow because the angel strokes it and caresses it and says, you're doing fine. It doesn't get flattered. It gets insulted. That's what happens. It gets beaten down. It receives the blow of a mailed fist. And that blow says, you're not where you should be. And that demonstration of its deficiency draws up that blade of grass. When the child's about to be born, he gets a blow. The blow is taken away from you. Your deficiency is what your perfection was before. So the child is born, not just a child who doesn't have, but a child who's just been robbed, just had it taken away, just had it pulled away from him. So he's born with an intense expression of emptiness. Not the emptiness that has never been filled. The emptiness of a vacuum that has been extracted, where the content has just been extracted. There's no greater blow than that. That's the meaning of this word. A person who teaches Torah, let's understand, what does it have to do with children cursing? What does the unborn child curse a person who flatters a person? But the meaning is obvious. The meaning is obvious. What is flattery? What is the role of a teacher? The role of a teacher is to take the student and give him the blow that demonstrates his deficiency. How do you bring up, how do you raise your blade of grass when you are the angel? How do you do that? You take this child, you take this student, you take this person you're responsible for, and you show them the level of deficiency. You show them the space that they need to swell to fill. And when you show that correctly, that's called teichacha. That's called tochacha. That's called rebuke. That's called correction. That's called... The very opposite is flattery. When you tell a person, you're fine, you're perfect already. So who curses a person? Do you understand what's happening? A person who denies... When you deprive an individual of their growth. Here's someone you're responsible for. And you could show them where they're deficient so that they could grow to their perfection. And you don't do that. You say you already reached your perfection. So you're cursed by the unborn child, the one who most potently feels... In his flesh, in his consciousness, he feels the experience of being there and having it taken away so that he can grow. He represents that in the world. That is the essence of this idea. So that's where the curse, the curse is from that essence. That there's a natural curse that goes out in the world. A person who perverts the purpose of creation. The purpose of creation is to help by demonstrating a deficiency so that the person can grow. You're not demonstrating a deficiency because you want to put them down. You want to bring them up. But how do you bring up a person who thinks he's already brought up? So you show him his deficiency. So he grows and he swells. So a person who flatters, instead of saying, you're deficient, you need to grow, this is where you're deficient. So the person can say, thank you, and start growing. You say, no, you're perfect already. So you're cursed by the child. You're cursed by that unborn child who represents in the world the force of, the idea of This is called, these are the polarities. The one side is called tochacha. That means rebuke, reproof, being demonstrated what's wrong with you. And the converse of that, the spiritual negativity of that, is flattery. And that's why it's called the fist of flattery. Do you understand? It's not a velvet glove. The Torah talks reality. The appearance is a velvet glove. It appears to be a most beautiful caress. You're fine, you're perfect, you're beseder, nothing to worry about. But there's no greater mailed fist than that, because the blow, on the contrary, the real gentle, loving touch, is the blow of having your deficiency demonstrated. The problem is, it's not easy. We don't like to have a deficiency demonstrated. The first time the Rebbe tells the Talmid what's wrong with him, he looks for another Rebbe. Doesn't need to be taught, he's perfect already. Perfect already. You know what the Gemara says? The Gemara says, how do we know? Let's understand. The Gemara says, how do we know? How do we know that the Yetzer Hara enters a child at birth? You know, the Gemara says that the Neshama, the soul, enters the child at conception. The soul enters at conception or thereabouts. And the Yetzer Hara, the negative inclination, the vested interest, the immature, self-seeking, yeah, that side of one's own lowliness, one's sensuous and earthy and animalistic nature, that enters at birth. And the side of spiritual elevation enters at bar mitzvah. So the Gemara says, how do we know that negativity, the force of negativity, enters at birth? How do we know that? The Gemara brings a proof. It says, because if the child had that force while he was yet unborn, he would kick his way out. Listen carefully to this. The Gemara says like this. How do we know that a child in the womb has no Yetzer Hara? He has no evil inclination. He has no negative force within him. He's only spiritually pure. Says the Gemara, because if it were not given at birth, when a child's born, he develops a negative. When a child is born, he has only self-interest. A child is a person. A child is a creature who thinks that the world is all him. Most, of course, people never outgrow that. Most people remain that sort of baby forever. That the world is all mine. And that's why they define love as being that you're here to serve me. Because I'm all that there is. But that's what a child is. A child is a creature, the whole world is for him. So when does he get that? When he's born. Says the Gemara, how do you know that he gets it when he's born and not before? Says the Gemara, because if a child would have it when he was yet in the womb, he would kick his way out of his mother. What's the meaning of this? The meaning is, said deeply, the meaning is that the Yetzer Hara, the deepest root of the evil side of human nature is, I am already perfect. Mevayet v'yotze means, I don't need any more development. Kicking his way out means, I don't need you, I don't need any more development. There's no deficiency that I need to grow to fulfill, I'm there already. I don't need pregnancy, I don't need any more nurture. And therefore the process of growth is always the process of, but it's hard. What is Teichacha? What is Musa? What does it mean to be what does it mean to have your deficiency demonstrated? You know the word Teichacha, you have to understand this. This is the painful part, yeah. This is what the 3 weeks mean to us, is facing our deficiencies. No one can tell you, because you and me, we are that baby who. So you have to do it yourself. You have to do it yourself. But you know what it means? Tochacha means, it does not mean someone telling you what's wrong with you. It means somebody proving to you from within yourself what's wrong with you. Tochacha in Hebrew means, the correct translation is reproof. Rebuke. You know what it means? Lochiach in Hebrew means to prove. What's the connection between giving a criticism and proving? What's the connection? Tochacha in Hebrew means lehochiach, means to prove. And it also means to rebuke. Because real rebuke, real criticism, is where I show you what's wrong with you from in yourself. Or it says, Oy lanu miyom adin, oy lanu miyom atoichacha. We have to beware and be terrified of the day of judgment and the day of rebuke. So the Brisker Rav used to say, what's the difference between judgment and rebuke? And he used to say, the second is much worse than the first. Judgment means what's wrong with you. So they open the book when you judged. Time of judgment. The book is open. They say, look, these are the rules. You broke them. So that, there's a way out. There's a way out. If you genuinely didn't know the rules, you weren't brought up, you weren't given an opportunity. You say, look, I never, to the extent that your claim is genuine, the book is closed. So then there's a second layer of judgment. And that layer of judgment is, let's not look at the book, let's look at your book. Let's look at where you provided your own standard and you didn't live up to your own standard. Let's look at a speech, and that's what happens. A video, you know, clips of your life are shown. And the frame pauses here for a while on a speech that you once made about being loyal to your friends. And then a few frames further is the time when you let someone down. That's called reproof. That's called rebuke. The claim here is not that you offended some external standard. The problem, you offended your standard. There's no way out of that. That you don't have to claim that you didn't have the education, no one showed you, no one told you. There's no way out of that. You can't. There's just no place to hide. Yeah. When they hold you up and they say, why weren't you a servant of Hashem the way you should be, the way you should have been? Why didn't you show alacrity and zeal for mitzvahs? Why didn't you drive yourself? Why didn't you get up early in the morning and drive yourself to serve Hashem, to perform your obligations? So you'll say Hashem, you'll say in judgment, you'll say, look, it's not my fault, you made me lazy. You say, you made me lazy, you built me that way, it's not my fault. You built me as a creature, I found it very hard. Then they roll the thing a few frames further, and they'll get, what are you getting out of bed at 4 in the morning to watch a few bozos kicking a ball around someplace across the world? So that you could wake up early for. So what are you going to say to that? What are you going to say to that? That's problematic. A few jokers halfway across the world pretending to be injured so that I... That's called tochacha. That means that there's a rebuke. And that's the job of an educator, is to... Yeah, that's the job. The job of an educator, the angel who teaches you, you know what the Gaon of Vilna says? It's one of the most chilling ideas. The Gaon of Vilna says that when you die, you know, the Gemara says when you die, three angels come to greet you. The Gemara says, you die, three angels come to meet you. One comes to add up all your mitzvahs, one comes to add up all your averas, all your transgressions, and one comes to see, heichan teirosoi ve'imi shlema biyodo. Where's your Torah? Where's your Torah, and is it complete in your hand? If you're a man, it basically means your Torah learning. If you're a woman, it basically means your Torah expression in the world, the kindliness that you put out into the world, the difference you made to the world, the expression of Torah, mitzvahs. There's a question here, why you need three angels? Because if you want to count up all your positive actions and want to count up all your negative, what do you need a third one for? What is there in your life that's not positive or negative? But it seems that there's a third element that also needs discussion. There's a third element, which is the totality of what you achieved. Where's your Torah that you produced in the world? Says the Gaon of Vilna, when that third angel comes to greet you, as he gets close, you recognize his face. He's the one who taught you Torah when you were an unborn child. He's the one who taught you. And now he taught you, there was a blow in the mouth, you were born as a screaming, unlearned child, and you spent your life trying to regain and recapture that knowledge. And he comes anxiously to greet you. That Torah that we learned together, that chavrusa that we had, that learning experience that we shared for 9 months when you were unborn child, did you do it? I gave it to you. Yes, and then you had it taken away so you could... That's the process. That's the process. Now the Rambam says, it's a mitzvah, you know, it's a mitzvah to rebuke, to criticize. Like the Gemara says, no one left alive who can do it. Because people can't do it, people can't take it. If I criticize you, you'll say to me, who are you? The Gemara says, if you say to a person, take the splint out of your eye, he turns around to you and says, why don't you take the beam out of yours? So who can do it? You have to be perfect to do it. But the Gemara says, listen to what the Rambam says. There are many categories of people who cannot do tshuva. People who cannot repent correctly. They have obstructions. They have obstructions. It's hard. There are many factors that make it hard to correct yourself. We're moving here through the 3 weeks. The Mitzvah Shem will get through it. We'll get to Elul, the time of tshuva, of self-correction. It's very hard. One of the categories is a person who cannot correct himself. Somebody who hates being criticized. Somebody hates being criticized. He hates to be criticized. Somebody doesn't like to be criticized. he's not going to grow. Because,
why?
He hasn't left himself an opening to go back. What way does he have to go back? How does he have to repair his ways? And because rebuke and criticism and being shown what's bad about you causes you to repent and correct yourself. Because listen carefully to this language. Because a person, a time when you tell a person what's wrong with him, and you shame him. He corrects himself. The Rambam doesn't mean you shame a person in public. That's not tshuva. That's not teichach. On the contrary, it's forbidden. You're not allowed to do that. You have to take a person aside and lovingly in private, and you have to do it with a complete conviction that it's only for his good, and he has to understand that it comes from love. That's the mitzvah. The Rambam doesn't mean that you embarrass him. The Rambam means you embarrass him. He means that he gets demonstrated to himself from within his own deficiency. He sees the shame of his own situation. Doesn't mean that he's embarrassed in front of you. That's what you have to do. Then he fixes himself up. Like it says, Zachov al tishkach, etc. Mami meyusim. And he quotes many places in the Torah where the Torah is a document of rebuke. Yeah, in this week, yeah, we're talking now, Moshe Rabbeinu, coming now to the parsha of Moses to rebuke the Jewish people in a delicate way. He reminded them of their sins with subtle nuance. But that's what he did. What are the books of the prophets if not intense castigation and criticism of the Jewish people? And that's what the prophets say to the Jewish people. Hoy goy chayte, you sinful people. Yad asher kaneu, even an ox knows his owner, etc. Krab agorin al tachse, cry out in your throat and do not hold back, he says to the prophet. Go and criticize the people. V'ken kol ha-nevim ochichu l'Yisrael. All the prophets criticized the Jewish people. Ochichu, that means they showed them what was wrong with them. Ad she'chazru b'tshuva, until they corrected themselves. Listen to this. Lefikach, therefore, tzarich lahamid b'chol kal v'kal m'Yisrael. In every Jewish community. Listen carefully here. Because this is where we are, you and me, we're now fulfilling this mitzvah, right? Your shul's not going to do it, I guarantee you. And they shouldn't, and they can't. So let's do it ourselves. Tzarich lahamid b'chol kal v'yisrael. Every Jewish community needs to establish chacham godol, a wise man, v'zakein old, v'yorei shemai minurov, God fearing from his youth, v'ov lahem, whom they love, she'emuchiach l'rabim, who can stand up in public and criticize people, and cause them to repent. We can't do it because there's no one left who can do this. Who is old and wise and God fearing from his youth that everybody loves? Who is there like that? Somebody who's really like that? Yeah, who really has that image? But he has to stand up in public and he has to correct them. But this is Senator Kochos, this person who hates to be corrected, he's not going to come to this public rebuke. And therefore he's not going to correct himself. But that's the mitzvah. That is the concept. That's the concept. The concept is that a person who flatters is a person who's actively depriving his ward, his child, his student. How do you criticize? It's a very delicate issue. But at least not flattery. At least not to take a person and show him where he's deficient and make him feel he's perfect. A person who withholds Torah. What greater... the whole purpose of being born is to learn Torah. The purpose of being born... the purpose of being is to learn Torah and manifest Torah in the world. So, Moneh Halacha Mipi Yotamit, somebody who could teach Torah and does not do it. What is he doing? He incurs the same curse. Here's a person who could show a deficiency. He could show a person his growth. Yeah, a person who flatters is a person who refuses to show where the deficiency is. A person who withholds Torah refuses to show the person where he could grow to. You need both. You need the blow that shows the deficiency, and you need to show. And therefore, these two categories of human beings, those who will not teach and those who flatter, are both defective in the same area. And therefore, they incur the curse of life itself, of the purpose of being born. The fetus that curses them is their own, of course. Yeah, that's what's meant here. Which unborn child? Which unborn child? You, when you were unborn. You need a teacher. You need a teacher who's prepared. The Chiddush HaRim says, and we'll finish with this. It's getting late. The Chiddush HaRim says that a person who walks at his master's right hand side Someone who walks at his Rebbe's right is an unlearned fellow. The simple meaning is because Torah derech eretz, that means Torah, the correct conduct is to walk at a great person's left. Because the right is the side of honor. So you walk with somebody who's honored, respected, your teacher, you put him at your right. Stand on his left. A person who walks at his master's right is a person who's unlearned. He doesn't even know the first principle of Torah etiquette, derech eretz, doesn't know. Says the Chiddush HaArim, a beautiful, masterful explanation. What does it mean to walk at the Rebbe's right? The simple interpretation, he doesn't know. Uncouth individual who's unlearned, doesn't even have the refinement of... But the deep meaning is this, the right hand side is always the side of the velvet glove of caressing. Chesed, the right hand side means only giving the outpouring of love with no criticism. That's the right hand side. The left, Kabbalistically, is always the side of discipline. Gevura means the blow. That's what the left is. The left is the blow of withholding, of withdrawal. A person who walks at his master's right is a person who only wants to hear. He walks in the relationship. In the light of, you're okay, you're fine, you're doing well, you're coming on, you're developing, don't worry. Such a person will always remain empty. Only the person who's prepared to walk at his master's left, when what he hears from his master is, you're no good, you're an idiot, you're a fool, you failed again. Of course, there has to be a Talmud who can take it. He has to know that it comes from love. He has to know that he's being told that because he has... The Hasidim say that if the Rebbe smacks you, if the Rebbe strikes you, you make a Kiddush. You make a Kiddush. That's a situation for rejoicing. If he ignores you, you're in trouble. If he ignores you, it means you're not worth correcting. Then you're in trouble. But if he upbraids you and corrects you, if your master teaches you, if your Rebbe... When you feel that blow that demonstrates your deficiency, that's a sign of love. It means you're worthy of being corrected. This is the idea, this is the message. And therefore in these 3 weeks, if there's a message that we need to take home, I can't take it and I can't give it. You no doubt have your own. Occasional deficiency, probably, somewhere. Normally I would tell you you're perfect, but since it's forbidden light of tonight's subject, I have to tell you that just like I have certain deficiencies probably somewhere, you probably also do. And in these 3 weeks, is the time to face that? Is the time to face it? Do you have any game plan? Yeah. Are you living up with consistency? Are you living with consistency simply in terms of your own values, let alone a higher set of values? This is the time to examine that question. You want to come to Elul, which is a time of tshuva and self-correction. First you need to go through these 3 weeks are a time of destruction. Time of destruction means to see what's been broken. You can't rebuild unless you see, yeah, what's been broken. You can't long for what's correct unless you feel the lack. Unless you felt that of the ecstasy being taken away, unless you felt that disappointment, that sense of abandonment, you can't long for it again. That's why it says, Sisu v'simu, rejoice all those people in the rebuilding of the temple, kolam misablima, all those who mourned. Rejoice in the rebuilding of the temple, all those who mourn for it. What does it mean? It doesn't only mean that all those who mourned will rejoice. It means because you mourned, you'll rejoice. The one who never mourns is not going to rejoice. When a man disappears and no one knows where he is, yeah, no one knows where he is, his wife is shattered, his children are broken, the neighbors are sad. Down the block they hear about it, and someplace else they don't even know. When that man comes home many years later, or sometime later, there's one person who's ecstatic. Their children are beside themselves. The neighbors smile. The people down the block hear about it. And the rest of the people have the same reaction they had when he disappeared. They don't know and they still don't. They didn't know then, they still don't know now. Those who feel the pain of the separation feel the ecstasy of the togetherness. And therefore, that's what these 3 weeks are for. These 3 weeks are for feeling the destruction. It's the destruction that you... Before you feel the destruction, the pain and destruction of the temple, you have to feel the destruction of the inner sanctum, the temple that's inside, that is no longer. The greatest tragedy is that we don't even feel that destruction. They have to open up a sensitivity to that pain. You're not going to be able to rebuild your own...